He could read you before you opened your mouth, shape your choices before you realized you'd made them. For years, he controlled every room he entered, until he met someone who flipped the script. This isn't just a story about manipulation. It's about obsession, mirrors, and the terrifying moment when the puppet master sees the strings attached to himself. Dive inside the mind of a master manipulator, if you dare. Welcome to the Skillful Art of Manipulation. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today, we present to you Inside the Mind of a Master Manipulator. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1. The Smile They Never Questioned. There are people in this world who walk into a room and instantly dominate it, not because they speak the loudest or dress the flashiest or command attention with brute force. No, they do it in silence, in stillness, in subtle shifts of air and posture that ripple through a space like the scent of something dangerous you can't quite place. I am one of those people. But that kind of power doesn't come from charm, charisma, or some inborn aura. It's engineered, refined, sculpted from years of observation, suffering, patience, and control. You don't just become a master manipulator. You are forged into one, often by fire no one else sees. The first time I realized I could bend people, I was sitting at the kitchen table, age 10, staring down a man who had the power to destroy me. My father, an ex-Marine turned alcoholic turned tyrant. His fists didn't need a reason. His anger was gasoline, and everything I did was a match. Breathe too loud? Slam. Glance sideways? Slam. Answer a question with the wrong tone? Slam. But I wasn't stupid. I watched. I listened. I studied him like prey studies the predator. I learned the rhythm of his breathing before he snapped. I learned the way his pupils dilated before a rage burst. I learned that if I timed my apologies just right, if I let my voice quiver just a touch, and my lower lip tremble like I was fighting back tears, I could make him pause. Not always, but enough. Enough to buy seconds, minutes. Sometimes enough to make him storm off instead of strike. And every time I succeeded, a tiny voice inside whispered, "You're not powerless." Not really. He is. And that voice became my gospel. It started there, in that toxic house. But I refined the art elsewhere. School was my second training ground. I quickly learned that authority figures were as easy to play as children. Teachers craved admiration. Administrators craved obedience, laced with just enough cleverness to make them feel they'd discovered a gifted student. I became that student. I asked thoughtful questions not because I cared, but because it made them feel seen, important, needed. My grades were average, but my reputation? Impeccable. I was the boy teachers trusted, principals praised, and counselors poured their personal stories into. I knew things about their divorces, their resentments, their fears of irrelevance. I never had to seek information. They gave it freely, in confidence, never realizing they were handing me weapons. Friends? That word means little to me. I didn't have friends. I had pieces on a board. I had test subjects. I had people I could push and pull, like marionettes, just to watch what they'd do. Would she turn on her best friend if I suggested he called her fat, behind her back? Yes. Would he cheat on his girlfriend if I played the broken, lonely confidant? Absolutely. And when the dust settled, I'd be there, the shoulder to cry on, the loyal bystander who never chose a side. I wasn't popular in the traditional sense. I didn't need to be. I was liked, that dangerous, kind of like where people don't quite know why they trust you, but they do anyway. The smile I wore wasn't real. It was armor, a carefully engineered expression I'd practiced in the mirror until it hit just the right balance between warm and unreadable. I didn't want people to see my soul. I wanted them to project theirs onto me. The more they saw what they wanted, the less they questioned what I actually was. By the time I turned 18, I'd mastered the unspoken, the way people reveal themselves not in their words, but in their habits. How someone touches their neck when they lie. How they fidget when you mention someone they envy. How their eyes shift when you lean in too close, not out of discomfort, but because they want you closer and don't know how to ask. People think manipulation is loud, dramatic, aggressive. It's not. It's quiet, gentle. It's planting a seed and letting them water it, all while thinking it was their idea to begin with. That's the real art. Make them choose what you already decided for them. College was where the game leveled up. I wasn't just manipulating for survival anymore. I was manipulating for pleasure, for gain. I knew which professors were flattered by challenge and which ones preferred docile agreement. I knew which students had access to money, power, influence. I became exactly what each one needed. Sometimes the brilliant rebel, sometimes the dependable loyalist, sometimes the flirt with a shadow behind his eyes. It wasn't about sex, though I used that too when I had to. It was about leverage, about understanding what people feared most, wanted most, and then becoming the person who could soothe that fear or promise that want. And the wildest part? No one ever suspected me, because I was always the guy who helped, the guy who got people, the guy who noticed when you were down, who asked just the right question, who knew when to say nothing. Silence is a beautiful tool, by the way. Let people fill in the gaps. Let them assume your silence means wisdom or empathy or strength. The truth? It was calculation. Always calculation. I once got a girl to drop out of school because I convinced her, slowly, subtly, over the course of 4 months, that she wasn't good enough. That her art wasn't special. That her professors were just being polite. I never said it outright. I just sighed a lot. Compared her to others. Suggested maybe it's just not your path. When she finally broke down and said she was leaving, she thanked me for being honest, for helping her see the truth. I didn't feel guilty. I felt godlike. Power does that to you. It rewires your morality. You stop thinking in terms of right and wrong. You start thinking in terms of cause and effect. Leverage. Response. Return on emotional investment. You begin to see people not as individuals, but as systems. Predictable. Hackable. Exploitable. Some people lie for fun. Some for profit. I lie because the truth is a blunt instrument, and I prefer scalpels. I lie because I'm good at it. No, great at it. I lie because I know that the most dangerous person in the room isn't the loud one. It's the quiet one with a pleasant smile and no visible motives. The one who listens more than they talk. The one who remembers the little things. The one who, by the time you realize what they're really after, already has everything they need. By 21, I didn't just play the game. I wrote the damn rules. And the best part? No one knew they were playing. Chapter 2, The Perfect Lie. People always ask the wrong question when it comes to manipulation. They ask, how do you lie so convincingly? What they should be asking is, how do you make them want to believe you? Because the truth is, people don't fall for lies because they're stupid. They fall because they need to. Because the lie fits the version of the world they're desperate to cling to. All I do is show them that version wrapped in a voice they trust. Let me take you back to the one that changed the course of everything for me. Her name was Lila. Red hair, freckles, the kind of smile that made you feel like spring just arrived early. I met her on the second floor of a cramped bookstore downtown, standing in the philosophy aisle like she belonged there, fingertips grazing the spine of being and nothingness, that overhyped existential brick by Sartre. She tilted her head and asked aloud, to no one in particular, "Why does everything have to be so heavy?" That was my cue. I didn't even look at her when I responded. I just said, because people confuse depth with density. She turned, smiled. Hook, line, sinker. Now here's the thing about Lila. She wasn't stupid. In fact, she was sharp, too sharp to fall for a surface-level trick. She was the type of woman who'd been burned before and built an entire identity around not letting it happen again. You could see it in her eyes, the constant evaluation, the mental measuring stick she used to calculate sincerity in real time. But what Lila didn't realize, what most people never do, is that skepticism can be just as exploitable as naivety. When someone wants to be proven right about their cynicism, they leave a back door wide open for someone like me to sneak through. So I did. I became the anomaly. The one who didn't try too hard, who didn't flirt, who listened, really listened, and responded like her thoughts actually mattered. I let her teach me things I already knew. I let her see my vulnerabilities, except they weren't real. I shared stories that sounded like secrets, but were really polished, rehearsed fragments designed to trigger her nurturing instinct. And God, did she fall for it? Not all at once, but slowly, like a sunrise through fog. We started seeing each other weekly, then daily, then constantly. She introduced me to her therapist, her childhood journals, her favorite poem about drowning. She wanted someone who didn't flinch at her darkness. I made sure I didn't just endure it, I romanticized it. You don't scare me, I whispered once, tracing the birthmark on her hip. I think your chaos is beautiful. She cried when I said that. Tears. Actual tears. And with each one that fell, I tightened my hold on her without ever needing to raise my voice or demand her attention. Manipulation isn't control through force. It's seduction through understanding. And I understood Lila like a fucking blueprint. She was a child of divorce. Father cheated. Mother drowned in martyrdom. She hated liars, but what she really feared, what she never said out loud, was being invisible, forgotten, replaced. So I made her feel unforgettable. I studied the patterns of her self-hate and made myself the antidote. She saw herself as too much? I told her she was intensely rare. She felt guilty for crying? I praised her emotional honesty. She hated how she overanalyzed everything? I made it sound like insight, like prophecy, like she was smarter than everyone in the room. I didn't just make her love me. I made her believe that loving me made her better. And that was the key to the lie. Because once she believed that being with me made her more whole, more valuable, more seen, she would do anything to keep me close. Anything. Now, I didn't need her money. I didn't need a place to stay. But I wanted something much harder to take. Access. You see, Lila worked for a nonprofit that handled private medical records, high-profile therapy clients, anonymous donors, all under tight digital security. But Lila? She had level 3 access and a laptop that remembered every password. The plan was never to hack her. That's what amateurs do. My approach was different. Slow. Precise. Surgical. One night, while we were curled up on her couch watching some moody indie film she loved, one of those where everyone's depressed and nothing resolves, I casually asked her what her work really involved. She hesitated. Then she opened up. I didn't press. I just nodded, listened, occasionally asked something that made her feel like I admired her integrity. I could never do what you do, I told her. That kind of responsibility would break me. She smiled. Said, most people don't understand how strict the rules are. I looked her dead in the eyes. That's why you're rare. You're not like most people. 10 minutes later, she was showing me her interface. Not in detail, just a glimpse. But it was enough. 3 days later, I left a browser tab open on her computer when I went to the kitchen to grab us wine. I knew she'd glance. It was a fake article about insider threats in nonprofits. The kind that makes you think twice. I told her later it was part of a research project I was thinking about. Something to help whistleblowers feel safer. She started telling me more. More than she should have. I didn't take anything right away. That would have been sloppy. Instead, I built routine. Normalcy. Trust. I spent 2 months crafting a script. One designed not to make her give me access, but to make her offer it. And she did. One late night, she said, you're the only person I've ever trusted with this. She typed in the master key, walked me through some files. You can't open anything, she laughed, but I thought you'd want to see the structure. And that was all I needed. I wasn't after patient files or blackmail. I wanted patterns, movement, behavioral rhythms, psychological profiles of the rich and unwell, the kind of information you could sell, trade, or use as leverage in the right digital circles. By the time I extracted what I wanted, Lila was already planning a vacation for us. Somewhere remote. Mountains. Cold air. Fireplaces. She wanted to tell me she loved me. She didn't get the chance. I ghosted her the day after I made the transfer. Changed numbers. Wiped everything. Moved cities. started fresh. New identity, new game. Some people might say, how could you do that to someone who loved you? But that's the wrong question again. What they should ask is, how did I make her love me in the first place? That's the art, not the escape, the entrance. Chapter 3, The Chameleon Complex. You can't survive at the top unless you know how to disappear in plain sight. Most people think manipulation is about dominance, about control, intimidation, seduction. And sure, sometimes those tools are necessary. But the most dangerous manipulators, the ones who rise to the highest levels of influence and walk through boardrooms like ghosts with keys, they don't impose themselves on the world. They adapt to it, seamlessly, invisibly. That's the part no one sees. The morphing, the quiet art of becoming exactly what each room needs. By the time I hit 23, I was no longer just faking personalities. I was absorbing them. Not copying, assimilating. I studied posture, tempo of speech, cultural nuance, dress codes by district. In the East Side tech circles, you wanted to be the visionary, quirky, fast-talking, slightly disheveled with expensive sneakers, and a curated playlist of TED Talks you never actually listened to. But over in finance? Different game. Silence, men control. Clean cuts. Tucked shirts. Cufflinks. Speak in tight, vague precision, and never show too much excitement. Because passion, there was weakness. So I became both. And everything in between. I called it the chameleon complex. I didn't just blend in. I replaced people's ideas of what was normal in a room. You ever walk into a space and feel like everyone already knows each other? Like there's some unspoken language you're too late to learn? I created that atmosphere. I dictated the emotional temperature. And then I'd pick my target. This time, it was a firm called Viral, a boutique digital intelligence company disguised as a PR agency. But under the hood, it was something darker. Influence engineering, algorithm manipulation, psychological data harvesting dressed up in branding campaigns. These people weren't just selling ads. They were shaping thoughts. I wanted in, not for the paycheck, not for the title, for the challenge. Viral was run by a board of six. Old money, new minds. A perfect blend of ego, paranoia, and ambition. The type of people who didn't trust anyone unless they felt like they were the smartest person in the room. And that's the sweet spot. Because once you make someone believe they're smarter than you, they relax. They let you in. They don't guard the door because they don't think you have the key. So I built a new identity, new degree, new LinkedIn footprint dating back 6 years, faked internships, recommendations from real people I'd briefly crossed paths with years before, edited screenshots, borrowed voice notes, deep fake audio when needed. The internet is a buffet if you know how to carve it. Then I bumped into Marsha Lin, the youngest board member, at a panel on ethical AI, held in a rooftop glass box gallery in the Arts District. She was magnetic, perfectly rehearsed, quoting Balaji and Foucault in the same breath. Everyone hung on her words like she was the reincarnation of Steve Jobs in a sheath dress. I didn't compliment her. That would have been too obvious. I questioned her. Don't you think it's a little dangerous, I asked, to equate predictive algorithms with ethical autonomy? I mean, you're assuming the data itself is clean when in reality, it's just a mirror of all our biases. She froze for a second, smiled, and then she did exactly what I hoped. She debated me for 27 minutes. The audience forgot the panel existed. All eyes shifted. Two minds locked. It wasn't flirtation. It was intellectual combat. And I let her win. Barely. Just enough to feel victorious. She offered me her card. Said, we need people like you at Viral. People who aren't afraid to challenge what's dangerous. I nodded. Said, only if they know how to spot danger. We laughed. But I wasn't joking. Within 3 weeks, I had an interview. Within 5, I was embedded. But I didn't climb the ladder. I built a staircase around myself. I found the weaknesses in their internal structure. Not in code, not in operations, in people. Jason West, the CFO, was in a secret affair with his younger male assistant, something I picked up from the way his hand lingered half a second too long on the guy's shoulder during Monday stand-ups. Kylie Grant, head of branding, had unresolved abandonment issues linked to her father's bankruptcy, which I pulled out of her after pretending I'd had a cousin in a similar situation. A month later, she was confiding in me about how scared she was to fail, how she always felt like she was one bad decision away from becoming just another broke marketing girl with a fake smile. I comforted her. I told her she had vision, that her instincts were sharp. I even suggested a few experimental campaign tweaks, knowing full well they'd backfire. When they did, I played the loyal second in command, helping her frame the fallout as part of a bold rebrand initiative. She called me her secret weapon. Jason called me dangerously insightful. Marcia called me essential. I didn't need to manipulate everyone, just the right ones. Because once I had influence over three of the six, the other three didn't matter. The board voted to promote me to strategic narrative consultant, a made-up title, but one with access to private meetings and long-range planning documents. The goal? Embed subliminal ideological shifts into corporate messaging without alerting the legal team. Tone engineering, they called it. The real goal? Get access to their behavioral model archives, the raw psychological blueprints of the voting public, scraped from devices and habits and unspoken responses. What could you do with that kind of data? Everything. You could ruin a senator with five micro-targeted ads. You could flip an election by triggering just the right insecurities in swing voters. You could crush a movement before it even knew it existed. And I wasn't just learning their system. I was replicating it. In private, I was building my own behavioral engine. Leaner, smarter, more ruthless. Because while viral saw people as numbers, I saw them as stories. And stories? They bend. One afternoon, I sat across from Marcia in a conference room with soundproof walls and a decanter of single malt whiskey between us. She was venting about internal misalignment and how she needed someone who understood narrative integrity at the highest level. I stared at her a long moment and said, "Marcia, you don't need alignment. You need loyalty." She paused, breathed, then whispered, "And what do you need?" I smiled. "Time." She nodded. She gave it to me. And in those weeks, I rewrote the future. For her. For viral. For myself. By the time I was done, two board members had resigned. One had taken early retirement, and Jason West had a quiet panic attack in a bathroom stall. Something I know because I planted the rumor that someone had hacked the board's shared drive. They hadn't. Not yet. But fear is a faster weapon than fact. I left viral shortly after. Clean. Quiet. With everything I needed. And as I sat in my apartment, overlooking a city pulsing with data and secrets, I realized something bone deep. I didn't want power anymore. I was power. And I wasn't even close to finished. Chapter 4. The Faithful Deceiver. You want to know the easiest people to manipulate? The ones who think they've outgrown manipulation. The ones who claim they've healed, elevated, or transcended. The ones who say, "I don't do drama anymore." Spirituality, in all its branded, sanitized, Instagram-filtered forms, is a fucking buffet for someone like me. See, religion used to be about faith. But now it's about image. It's about identity. It's about performance. And where there's performance, there's ego. And where there's ego, there's leverage. I infiltrated the oasis not for profit, but for curiosity. I wanted to see what happened when people surrendered their critical thinking in the name of oneness. I wanted to see how deep I could go into the rabbit hole before even the shepherds forgot I wasn't one of their sheep. The Oasis was a non-denominational, quantum-embodied healing space, whatever the hell that means. In practice, it was a rebranded cult dressed up in artisanal teas and tantric breathwork. No crosses. No robes. Just recycled mantras, crystal grids, and a $2,000 monthly donation minimum to maintain energetic flow. You couldn't get in through a sign-up form. You had to be invited. I made sure I was. It started with Jasmine. God, Jasmine. 28, yoga sculpted, ethereal to the point of being barely tethered to earth. She wore robes in soft desert tones and had a voice like a lullaby whispered through smoke. I met her at a retreat in Sedona after pretending to be a burned-out ex-founder seeking clarity. She liked the darkness in me, said it made me potent, said my auric field was fractured, but reparable. I told her I hadn't cried in 10 years. She touched my chest and said, "That's not your fault." And just like that, I was in. She brought me to the Oasis's inner circle, introduced me to Nico, the founder, a soft-spoken sociopath with messiah delusions and perfect bone structure. Nico wore white linen every day and rarely blinked. He spoke in slow, hypnotic cadences designed to lull you into surrender. "Control is an illusion," he'd say, "but awareness is the key to true freedom." I smiled when he said that, because I understood control better than anyone in that room. I understood that his illusion was being the one who didn't need it, when in fact, he craved it like air. Every Tuesday, they hosted integration nights, group confessions under dim lights, where people released trauma, sobbed into woven blankets, and collapsed into each other like newborns relearning touch. It was beautiful, vulnerable, raw, and utterly exploitable. The trick was simple. I didn't speak for the first 3 weeks. Not a word. Just presence. Just deep, soulful eye contact, a few carefully placed exhales, and the occasional nod of spiritual recognition. That silence? It drove them crazy. They filled in the blanks with projections of wisdom, pain, sacred masculinity. They needed me to be mysterious. So I let them. By week 4, people were asking me to lead the grounding exercises. By week 6, Nico was quoting me. I didn't give advice. I asked questions, open-ended, probing questions designed to feel like keys to inner truths. What would happen if you stopped trying to heal and just accepted that you were broken? Or what if the fear you're avoiding is actually your most honest self? They fucking ate it up. One night, Jasmine told me I was more awakened than any man she'd ever met. I whispered, "Maybe that's because I never pretended I wasn't asleep." She gasped, said it felt like prophecy. What she didn't know was that I'd said the same line to a woman in a hotel bar 3 years earlier, right before stealing her company's internal access codes. It's all the same, just different packaging. I started keeping a journal, not for myself, for them. I wrote entries designed to be discovered. I'd leave pages open, scrawled with haunting fragments like, "Do I lead them because I care or because I can? If I become their mirror, do I lose my own reflection?" Jasmine read them. She never admitted it, but I saw the way her eyes lingered, the way her breathing changed when she thought I wasn't watching. She started calling me the shepherd. And so the myth began. Nico didn't like that. I saw it. The tension, the tightening of his jaw, the subtle exclusion in circle talks. He'd interrupt me more, invite me to private energy recalibrations, which were just thinly veiled attempts to read me, to assert dominance. I let him, because I was already inside the house. What he didn't know was that I'd started recording our conversations. Not for blackmail, at least not at first. But because I knew how powerful a man's voice sounds when he believes no one else is listening. And Nico? He confessed things in private that would have shattered his entire kingdom. "I don't even believe in half this shit," he told me once, high off a microdose cocktail. But they need it. People need a daddy who tells them what's real. Otherwise, they implode. I didn't blink. I just said, "You're not wrong." And he laughed. Like we were the only two real people in a world full of broken toys. The moment I knew I'd won was during a full moon gathering in the desert. 47 members sat in concentric circles around fire. Nico was giving his usual sermon about shedding ego, but the crowd wasn't locked on him. They were looking at me, waiting, breathing with me. I didn't even stand. I just spoke. "I used to believe healing meant becoming whole," I said. "Now I think healing means becoming honest, even if that honesty is ugly." A woman sobbed. A man started shaking. Jasmine kissed my hand. And Nico? He smiled, but I could see the rot under it. He knew. He knew that if I stayed one more week, he wouldn't just lose control. He'd lose faith. Faith is a currency in these circles. Not belief in God. Not even belief in yourself. faith in someone else's certainty. And mine was louder, so I left, on my terms. I wrote a final message, left it in the altar room. There are no leaders, only mirrors. Be careful who you reflect. Then I walked out barefoot before sunrise, back into the world of noise and concrete and consequence. And as the sun climbed behind me, I whispered to myself, they'll never know I never believed a word of it. But the scariest part? Sometimes I wonder if part of me did. Chapter 5, The Breaking Point. Every master eventually meets their match. I used to think I was immune, untouchable. That no matter how deep I sank into someone else's psyche, I always kept a tether tied around my own. I was the god behind the curtain, pulling strings with a calm, clinical smile. But arrogance is the slow poison you drink believing you're immune. Her name was Sarah, short for Serafina, though she hated that name. Said it sounded like something a cult leader would name a daughter he planned to sacrifice. I met her in a moment I wasn't supposed to be vulnerable, in a setting I wasn't prepared to control. It was a funeral. My estranged cousin, one of the few family members I hadn't burned bridges with, had overdosed. I didn't cry. I didn't even really feel. But I showed up, not because I cared, but because showing up creates the illusion of connection. And illusions matter when you're trying to protect what's left of your reputation. Sarah was standing by the side of the chapel, black dress, cigarette, no tears. She didn't look like someone mourning. She looked like someone watching. That's what caught me. Her stillness. I know that kind of stillness. It's the kind that masks a sharp mind. She looked at people the way I did. Predator recognizing predator. We didn't speak at the funeral. Not a word. Just a glance. A nod. She vanished after the final hymn. 3 days later, I saw her again, by chance, or fate, or maybe design, in a bookstore. Of all places. She was sitting on the floor between aisles, flipping through The Denial of Death by Ernest Becker, of all goddamn books. I said nothing. Walked past. She didn't look up. Then I heard her voice. You ever wonder if everyone you manipulate is just a part of you you've refused to understand? I froze. Turned. She didn't smile. Didn't even look at me. Just kept turning the page. I should have walked away. I wanted to walk away. Instead, I sat down beside her. She finally met my gaze. Up close, she was stunning in that elusive, timeless way, like she was born out of an era that never existed. Wild eyes. Scar just beneath her collarbone. Everything about her said danger. And yet I leaned in. What if manipulation is understanding? I asked her. She smirked. Then you must be very lonely. That line struck something I hadn't felt in years. Not guilt. Not shame. Recognition. We talked for hours that night. About everything, nihilism, childhood trauma, quantum physics, Dolly, dopamine, death. She didn't flirt. She didn't perform. She dissected. Every word out of her mouth felt like it was wired to explode. I tried steering the conversation more than once. She noticed. She let me think I had control, then pivoted with a single sentence that collapsed the frame I'd been building. It was terrifying and exhilarating. For the first time in my life, I wasn't sure if I was leading the dance or just being pulled by someone who knew a tune I didn't. We started seeing each other. Not romantically. Not sexually. Not normally. We shared silence more than anything. Sometimes we'd just sit in the back of abandoned buildings and breathe. Other times, she'd take me to underground art shows where everything was either bleeding or on fire. She'd say things like, "You remind me of a sadistic architect," and I'd respond with, "You're the only person who could design the trap I'd walk into willingly." It was mental chess, and I didn't always win. One night, in her tiny apartment filled with dried flowers and handwritten notes taped to the ceiling, she asked me something no one had ever dared to ask. "What's your real name?" I hesitated. "Why does it matter?" I deflected. "Because I want to know the version of you that existed before the masks. The boy. Before the weapon." I told her, quietly, the name I hadn't spoken aloud in over a decade. The one I buried when I decided the world didn't deserve the soft parts of me. She didn't flinch. She just nodded. "Thank you," she said. "He's still in there. Somewhere." She made me feel seen. And I hated it. Because once you start feeling seen, you start wanting to be understood. And that's the most dangerous craving of all, for someone like me. The cracks began to show. I started making mistakes. Subtle, but present. Forgetting small details during a client con. Slipping up in conversations I normally would have puppeteered with surgical finesse. I was off balance. And I knew why. Sarah was under my skin. But it wasn't love. No. It was rivalry. She was the first person who ever made me question if I was the one in control. So, I did what I always do when something threatens my structure. I decided to destroy her. It started with small acts. Withholding information. Testing her patience. Dropping seeds of doubt in her inner circle. Friends she never really trusted. Exes who still watched her social feed like worshippers. I made it seem like they were the problem. Isolated her ever so gently. And yet she didn't break. She adapted. She saw it. Maybe not every move, but enough to know I was shifting. She confronted me one night. No drama, no accusations. Just a soft whisper across a candlelit table. "You're trying to undo me," she said, her eyes steady. "And part of you hates that it's not working." I looked at her. And for the first time in years, I felt afraid. Not of her. Of myself. Because I didn't know why I was doing it anymore. Was it to win? Or was it because if she wasn't afraid of me, if she didn't unravel like all the others, then maybe everything I believed about myself wasn't true? That was the night I broke. I didn't rage. I didn't scream. I just sat in the dark after she left, listening to the sound of my breath, realizing how empty the room felt without her presence. I had never been addicted to people, only to their weaknesses. But with Sarah, I was addicted to the fact that I couldn't find hers. And maybe that meant mine was finally exposed. The next day, she vanished. No note. No text. Nothing. Like she was never real at all. And maybe that's what haunts me. Not the silence. Not the loss. But the possibility that someone finally looked through the glass walls I built around myself. And chose to walk away. Chapter 6. The Mirror Maze. The thing about masks is that if you wear them long enough, they stop being disguises and start becoming skin. And when they crack, they don't shatter clean. They splinter. Jagged. Relentless. Piercing from the inside. After Sarah disappeared, my world didn't collapse. Not at first. It held. I still walked the streets in tailored silence. Still wore the right smiles. Said the right things. I still manipulated. Still seduced. Still orchestrated every room I entered like a maestro no one could see. But something was different. Something was off. It was like someone had rearranged the walls of a house I thought I'd built brick by brick. I still had the floor plan memorized, but the doors didn't open the same way. The angles were sharper. The shadows longer. I kept walking into spaces I didn't recognize inside myself. And worst of all, I couldn't find the script. I couldn't hear the voice that always whispered what to say, when to shift, when to hold silence like a blade, and when to shatter it with a lie disguised as love. Sarah didn't just walk out of my life. She rewired it, and I began to question things I shouldn't have. I started second-guessing my moves, doubting my instincts. I hesitated, and in the world I built, hesitation is fatal. Because once you hesitate, you give people time to see you. And if they see you, they can hurt you. That's when the nightmares started. They weren't loud. They weren't bloody. They were worse. They were still. I'd be standing in a room full of mirrors, floor to ceiling, infinite. And every reflection was me. But each version looked just slightly off. One blinked when I didn't. Another was smiling. Another one stared with pitch black eyes and whispered, "You're not the master. You never were." I'd wake up drenched in sweat, heart clawing its way out of my chest, eyes scanning the dark for something I couldn't name. And in the hours between 3 a.m. and sunrise, when the world feels most unguarded, I began to wonder, had I ever really been in control? Or had I just been the most obedient puppet? That question became a sickness. I started looking back at the people I'd broken, the lovers I'd manipulated, the colleagues I'd turned into weapons, the friends I'd sculpted into pawns. And I didn't feel regret. I felt paranoia. What if I hadn't orchestrated their choices? What if someone had orchestrated mine? I tried to push it down. Tried to reset. I took on a new project. One that should have been easy. A widow named Claire. Wealthy. Lonely. Deep in grief. Clinging to rituals and memories and scented letters she still sprayed with her late husband's cologne. She was supposed to be simple. She needed comfort. Validation. A shoulder with just the right tension. Strong enough to lean on. Soft enough to pretend it wouldn't push back. I gave her all of it. I mirrored her grief, her fears, her stories. I told her I'd lost someone too. Spoke about my brother who overdosed, borrowed details from my cousin's funeral. Just enough truth to make it stick. She latched on, quickly. But something kept pulling me out of character. Some fracture inside me I couldn't tape shut. I'd find myself asking questions I didn't mean to ask, honest ones. Vulnerable ones. Do you ever feel like your life isn't yours? She blinked. Every day, she whispered. Since he died. And just like that, I wasn't guiding the conversation anymore. She was. Claire started seeing me. Not the projection. Not the design. Me. And it terrified me. Because the real me? He was never built to be seen. He was built to observe. To adapt. To survive. I began pulling back. Missing meetings. Ignoring calls. Wandering into the city at odd hours like a ghost looking for the living. That's when I saw the envelope, tucked beneath my apartment door. No name. No stamp. Just a single card inside, handwritten in that sharp, slanted print I hadn't seen in months. You think you're playing a game, but you're still in the mirror. Sarah. She hadn't disappeared. She'd gone underground. And the more I thought about it, the more things started to shift, to bend backward, to click. The bookstore. The funeral. The way she had spoken to me on that first day, like she'd known me before I even spoke. Had she been watching me longer than I thought? Had I ever been the one in control? The idea made my stomach twist. So I did what I always did when backed into a corner. I dug. I spent days tracing digital footprints, IP addresses, forum posts on obscure philosophy boards. I found breadcrumbs, tiny anomalies I'd missed. Sarah's accidental run-ins weren't accidents. She'd orchestrated them. Every one. She'd profiled me. She'd baited me. She had flipped the entire script, and I didn't even know it. I sat in that realization for hours. And for the first time since I was 10 years old, when I learned how to cry without tears to stop my father's belt from landing too hard, I felt powerless. Not because someone had hurt me, but because someone had outplayed me perfectly. That night, I looked in the mirror again, and I didn't recognize the man staring back. Not because he looked different, but because he didn't. He looked exactly the same, and that scared me more than anything. Because it meant I'd never known who I was beneath the manipulation. Every layer I peeled back wasn't a revelation. It was just another version of a lie I told myself to survive. A performance so good I believed it. Until she showed me the script wasn't mine. It never was. Chapter 7. The Final Move. There's always one final play in the game. One checkmate move no one sees until the king is already dead. I used to believe I would never be that king. That I'd built myself into the kind of player who designed the board. The one who made the rules, bent the pawns, sacrificed knights, and crowned myself with a silent, smug smirk while the rest of the world clapped for an illusion. But now I was staring at the board with all my pieces missing. And Sarah was still playing. That envelope, that single line, you think you're playing a game, but you're still in the mirror. Wasn't just a taunt. It was a declaration. She knew. All of it. My tics. My triggers. My patterns. And not just in the way a lover learns your breath in the dark. No. She researched me. Studied me. Reverse engineered me like a code she was rewriting from the inside out. And I, so arrogant, so confident in my invisible strings, never even felt the snip. For weeks I spiraled. Not outwardly. I kept the suit sharp, the smile ready, the lies smooth. But inside, Inside, I was fracturing. Every memory of her felt weaponized. Every word she'd ever said now played back with new context, like a film rewatched after a twist ending. You notice things you didn't the first time. You see, like the way she always let me lead a conversation, only to pivot it somewhere deeper, into a corner I didn't realize she'd painted. Like the way she asked questions no one else ever did. Questions that didn't flatter, but pierced. Like the way she disappeared just as my mask began to slip. Sarah wasn't running. She was orchestrating the finale, and I was about to walk right into it. The second letter came exactly 12 days after the first. Different paper. Same writing. I'll give you what you want. Come find me. You know where. I knew immediately. It was a place we'd visited together once, a decaying theater just outside the city, long condemned, overtaken by vines and silence. We'd broken in one night to lie beneath the stage lights and read poetry to each other. She said the ghosts there listened better than any living audience. Back then, it felt like magic. Now it felt like bait. But I went. Because what else does a dying king do when the throne is burning? The air was damp with rot and memory. Shattered seats leaned like broken teeth. Moonlight spilled in through a cracked dome. Dust swirled with every step I took. And there she was, Sarah, sitting on the stage like she was born there, cross-legged, hair pinned back, notebook in her lap. No smile, no drama, just waiting. She looked up. You came. You summoned me. Did I? I walked closer, stopped 10 feet away. She closed the notebook, set it beside her. I suppose you're wondering what this is, she said. I stopped wondering. I started remembering. A flicker in her eyes. Good. That's where it begins. I stepped forward. So what is this, Sarah? Revenge? Redemption? A lesson in poetic irony. She shook her head slowly. None of that. This, she gestured to the empty theater. This is a mirror. You and your goddamn mirrors, I muttered bitterly. They're the only truth you ever see, she said, because you never believe anyone else's version. Why would I? I snapped. Everyone lies. Everyone projects. People aren't honest. They're desperate. Desperate to be wanted, understood, forgiven. They build false selves and beg others to validate them. I just learned to read those scripts before they even opened their mouths. Her silence was deafening. Then she said, "And what if someone read yours?" I didn't answer, because in that moment I realized the truth. She had. She knew me more deeply than anyone ever had. She had peeled back every layer, every justification, every weapon I wielded, and held it up like a trophy. "You think manipulation is a game," she said, "but you've never known what it means to feel. To truly surrender control. To trust. That's why you can't stop doing it. Because the alternative, being real, terrifies you." "You don't know what I've lived through," I shot back. "I don't have to," she said. "I know what you did with what you lived through." That shut me up. I lowered my gaze, staring at the cracked wood beneath my feet. Somewhere above us, wind howled through broken glass. She continued, softer now. "You build prisons, and you make people love their cages. You convince them that the bars are protection. You offer them intimacy, then punish them for wanting more. But the worst part? You've locked yourself in, too." I clenched my fists, because every word was true. She walked to me, barefoot, slow, unafraid. Stopped just inches away. "I didn't come to hurt you," she whispered. "I came to give you the one thing no one else ever could." "What's that?" She reached into her coat and handed me an envelope. It was thick. Inside were photographs, documents, emails, dates, times. All about me. She'd built a full dossier. My aliases, my cons, the trails I thought were untraceable. "You've been playing in the dark for a long time," she said. "But you're not invisible anymore." My pulse thundered. "You're going to expose me?" I asked, voice cold. "No," she said. "I'm giving you a choice." "What kind of choice?" "Burn it. All of it. Start over. For real. Not with new lies. With truth. Or walk away and know that I could have ended you and didn't." I stared at her, at the fire in her eyes, at the calm. She wasn't bluffing. She had everything. And she wasn't using it to destroy me. She was using it to free me. I laughed. It came out broken. Do you really think I know how to be anything other than this? She touched my chest. I think the boy inside you still remembers who he was before he had to become this. Silence. I dropped to my knees. Not for her. For the version of me I'd buried a lifetime ago. And for the first time in my life, I wept. Not crocodile tears. Not performative sadness. Real. Violent. Trembling sobs. And she stayed. She sat beside me. Held the weight I didn't know I still carried. And when the sun broke through the broken roof hours later, I realized something. She hadn't just played the game better than me. She'd rewritten the rules. And somehow, she'd saved me in the process.